is Rose Manabusin from More in the Pacific National Historical Park, and I'm doing an interview with Arthur Armstrong and his involvement during World War II. Can you give me your full name?
Arthur Alvin Armstrong, Sr.
And your place of residence?
1240 Valley Drive, Laurel, Montana, 59044.
Okay, also your occupation or your profession now?
I am retired.
I'd like to go back to the period of December 7th, 1941, if you could tell me where you were, and we'll start from there.
Well, I was visiting a buddy of mine, lived out south of my hometown, and so we drove into town to get some cigarettes, and we found out that the Japs attacked Pearl Harbor, and a buddy of mine, he'd been after me for several months to join Marine Corps, and I said, I'm going to finish high school. Well, I said, if anything happens, I says, count on me to be with you. So when we found out, well, we shook hands. And next day, we went into the recruiting office and took our brief physical, such as it was, and then went over to the doctor's office for his examination. And as we were passing out the door of the Northern Hotel, I heard President Roosevelt make the announcement of a declaration of war against Japan. That evening at about 11:30, we boarded the train in Billings and proceeded to Butte, Montana, for our first good physical. And while there, I found out that I was probably the youngest recruit that has ever enlisted in the Marine Corps.
And how old were you?
Corman called me in the office and asked me how old I was, and I told him I was 19. He asked me when my date of birth was. I said, well, 13 November 1922. He said, not according to your records, I said, what do they say? He said, 1941. So I figured from then I was officially the youngest recruit that was ever enlisted in the Marine Corps. But we got that straightened out, and I was able to go on to being sworn in and sent to San Diego at Marine Corps Base, where I really got the torture. And then through first few days, it was touch and go, drawing equipment, getting that nice GI haircut, and then we went on a training schedule, which was 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. And it was a fast 3 weeks.
Was your training?
Pardon?
Where was the training at?
San Diego, Marine Corps Base.
You were still at San Diego then?
Yes. And following boot camp training, I was with a rifle range detachment at Army Base of San Luis Obispo for about 3.5 months. And from San Luis Obispo, returned to Marine Corps Base, a casual company, waiting orders, to which in 3-4 days I was at Camp Elliott, north of San Diego, trying to get in the 2nd Raider Battalion, but I just didn't have what they wanted, so I was then assigned to K Company, 3rd Battalion, 9th Marines, which I served with from 21st of March till 15 July, 42, I was transferred to Company of 2nd Battalion, 9th Marines, where I served with the 2nd Battalion, 9th Marines from 15 July to 3 May 1945, wherein I returned to San Francisco and San Diego on 17 May 1945 when I got back to the States. Mm-hmm. But going back, telling him my tour of duty with Company F, 2nd Battalion, I'll go back to the time we were overseas, went overseas, the 24th day of January. Left San Diego for Auckland, New Zealand. Was down there five and a half months, and from New Zealand then we went to Guadalcanal, which was our advanced jungle warfare training in preparation for the Bougainville operation on 1 November 1943. And we were there, well, to the 27th of December. And at present time, I'm with two very dear friends of mine, Jack Eddy and Joe Bell. That's probably our reason to be here again after 43 years on Guam. I'll probably get a little ahead of my story, but anyhow, we left Guadalcanal and on the 2nd of June, 44, by way of Kwajalein, Saipan, Eniwetok, and then 21 July, we were setting out here 13 miles at sea for the invasion. And I'd always wanted to see an invasion softening up process. And lo and behold, I saw it. And it's a sight I'll never forget.
Can you describe that? Pardon? Can you describe how it looked to you?
Well, I was, there were four Marines and four sailors and two naval officers assigned to landing parties, beach party for ship to shore. It was equipment, troops, equipment. And so we moved our equipment down in the tank glider we were to work off of during the unloading. So the first big shells that whistled overhead, I was out of my blanket roll and standing aboard ship watching the fireworks. And a lot of it's like most combat, you just about got to see that, be there to see it. And it was a great fireworks, that's about near as I can say. It makes you wonder how anything or anyone could survive after a shelling and dive bombing and strafing that the beach received during the initial invasion. And we were, our first trip to the beach, we went to, pardon? Our first trip to the beach was to be a half track from regimental weapons and a load of troops. We were about 13 miles out at sea, and we went to the President Adams to pick up the troops and head to the beach. Well, we quite a little stretch of time getting from transport to the beach, traveling over fairly smooth water, and we had. We're almost to the beach when the Japs up in the hills opened up with artillery and let us have it. And we sustained didn't hit the craft or the troops, but lit close to us, and we had three casualties. Our first trip, we hadn't reached the beach or the reef. And one of my fellas got a piece of shrapnel in his hip, another through the top of his foot. And one of the sailors got a piece of shrapnel that went through the steel jacket of his helmet and just barely through the fiber liner. Didn't go through, but he had an awful headache, and he was. So when we get into the reef and unloaded our cargo, we went back to the to our mother ship, and which had moved in considerably closer to the beach. And we unloaded our casualties, and I went aboard ship and got replacements. Mm-hmm. And then we took a bulldozer, an operator in with other ammunition and supplies. And closer, and we got probably 300 yards from the beach, they opened up on us again. We had to swing out from the beach and wait till we got a chance to go in to the beach. And we had the ramp down, and the coxswain told the driver, warm that baby up and get her moving. Mm-hmm. So as soon as he got off, well, we backed up and wham, right where we'd been sitting on the reef, a round went off. And thank God that we were back far enough that we never received any casualties. It so happened that the catches on the ramp on the tank ladder would not go down, could not release them, so we had to go one on each side of the boat, go down and flip the catch, and then the ramp would go down. Mm-hmm. And which was pretty hairy, but I guess we hired all these tough hands, so we figured we could do it. Mm-hmm. And the first day we had, we made five trips into the beach with jeeps and various other pieces of equipment, heavy equipment, and rations of all make and size and form. And our last trip, while we were at the beach, we had to wait for another bombardment on the beach. Started back to our mother ship, and the convoy had pulled out to sea, so we were out there orphans. We picked out a certain ship there that was in the harbor, go over and kind of tie up alongside and possibly get to go aboard ship for the evening. But they wouldn't let us, so we just had to float around out there by ourselves. And our first night, we were on the water, which wasn't the most comfortable place because the bottom of the landing craft had about 4 or 5 inches of water in it, and didn't want to lay down in that. So we all hovered around the coxswain stand, hoping to be there when the sun come up the next morning without rolling off into water. So we. Next morning we went aboard the merchant ship and had breakfast and got to clean up a little bit, and then back to our job, the ship to shore, which lasted till the afternoon of the 25th of July, when we came aboard on the beach and located our 2nd Battalion 9th Marine supply section, to whom we were to work with. Mm-hmm. And so we had no more and got ashore when we loaded up with everything, all the ammunition of every kind that we could possibly carry, water cans and rations, about 12, 14 of us, and up over the Chinito Ridge, over to Fonte, to Company F, and was there long enough to resupply what we had, and was ordered off the ridge because the skipper said all hell was going to break loose. So we got back to our supply area at dark, found where we could find to crawl in a hole and call it a night. And that was our job after we got to the beach and into the operation. We were working with the supply section. Being a cook, that was one of our jobs, either a supply personnel behind the lines or a stretcher bearer. And I got in on both, stretcher bearer and also pack mule for ammunition and everything that the troops on the front lines.
Pack mule?
Well, call himself a pack mule.
Can you explain it? I'm not familiar with the phrase.
A pack mule is a mule that's used, especially by the Forest Service, for packing supplies back into mountains. And you always consider any ground pounder that's got to do a lot of packing. You call yourself a pack mule.
Oh, I see.
In other words, it's just a kind of a slang for whatever opportunity you want to use it for. And so we put everything with bandoliers and ammunition around our necks and grenades in our pockets and water can in one hand and help somebody with the case of hand grenades and machine gun ammunition. We take off up the trail to either battalion or wherever we had to go with the equipment. And sea rations the same way. Just a human chain, more or less, taking off over the hump. And so we did get up, took supplies up to Fonte Ridge the morning after the big battle.
What did it look to you like then?
Very grisly, gruesome. You see, it looked like there must have been thousands of bodies piled up laying out there on
the Japanese. This was below Fonte Ridge?
This was on the invasion side where the Japs came up to take the ridge. I've never seen too many dead people before, and I don't think I've seen any since as they were piled up there. It was very gruesome, but that's the rigors of war. Mm-hmm. And whether it be us or somebody else, the enemy especially. So we eventually, in a few days, moved to the high ground after the troops had jumped off in the advance to secure the island. Every 2 or 3 days or 4 days, we'd move up behind the troops with our supply and keep them in dire need of ammunition, food, and water. And when we reached the northern end of the island, we moved back to, where the present airport is in here in Agana. And then from there, we went down to a new training area between Ilig and Talafofo Bay, where we cleared the area and set up a nice camp, had a nice view of the ocean, big reef there where we go out and look for cat eyes and whatever else. And we were there till the 10th of the 9th of February, and then we went down to Sumay and boarded transport to go to Iwo Jima.
Did you meet any locals during that time?
The natives?
Yes.
Well, I never met any of them personally that I could call by name, but I saw a lot of them. They were real nice to them. They were real nice to me, and probably the finest people I've ever met. And I still think so. I have down through the years, and since I've come back, I find that they haven't changed much. They're still very friendly, and I'm sure they appreciated the job of what we did and bringing them back to us. And I was up at Iwo till after the operation, came back to Guam the 10th of April. And from the 10th of April till the 3rd of May, I was back home again. I called it back home. And then I took off for the States. And I was stationed at Marine Corps Base in San Diego till the remainder of my enlistment. And on 15 December 1945, I was discharged from the Marine Corps. But I always, in back of my mind, I always thought I want to come back. Come back to Guam. And someday I will get back. And I know it's going to probably be a long struggle unless I re-enlisted in the Marine Corps and come back over here as personnel, which on active duty, I never got back here until Sunday morning, you know, first trip back home. And I call it my second home. And it's been a dream that's for 40 years that I finally got to fulfill. And I kept thinking, I liked the Marine Corps, good to me, and I saw a lot of country I'd never seen otherwise, and some people hate every minute they've spent in the military, and me, it's just the opposite. I think I loved every minute that I spent with the Corps, and I put in 19 and a half years with the active reserve in my hometown, and retired as a career reservist in 1 May 1972, and in 13 November, on my 60th birthday, I was officially retired in a proper ceremony at Marine Corps Birthday Ball, with the total of 39 years, 8 months, and 7 days satisfactory service. And it was a long haul down the road, but I knew each day I was getting a day older, and each month, year. I didn't think that last 10 years would ever get to me, but it came, and I don't regret one day that I spent. If I had to do over, I'd do the same thing.
How do you feel about World War II? How do you feel it affected your life or yourself personally?
Well, I've always been what you might call a patriot. I was always proud of my country, and I always read everything on history that I could, and especially the expansion of the nation from 1775, 76, through to the present day. And I've always been an advocate of a strong military force, and I think I'll probably die in the same thoughts. I figure when the flag goes up and they say come, I went before and I can always go again. I was fortunate that I spent 1 year during the Korean War on active duty. The rest of the time was reserved. And, like I've said before, and I never went to Vietnam, but had we been mobilized, the reserve been mobilized, where I'd had to go, I would have had no qualms about it. I'd have gone and did what I could. And like I did before. So I feel I'm very, like I say, I am very much an advocate of a strong, strong nation. And not be second, third, but number one. We've come from behind to be number one in two or three wars. But she's still the greatest country in the world, and it's worth fighting for.
Can I ask you, what is your reason for returning to Guam now, today?
Well, like I said, it's been a 40-year dream to come back and see the changes in the period from my last visit here, or last tour of duty here, and to try to retrace my footsteps on the island during the invasion, occupation of Guam. And a good friend, Jack Eddy, has invited me over for the last 3-4 years, and we finally got to fulfill this dream, and now we're here to attempt as close as we can to do what we did 43 years ago. Mm-hmm. Only this time, see it without somebody shooting at me and looking through most of the territory and the ground here through the sights of a rifle. It's really been great. I couldn't begin to visualize how modern the city of Gannon and the island itself, mm-hmm. Compared to what it was when I was here. It just wasn't. And of course, you forget that time marches on and nothing stays the same, and it's been a great improvement for, I'm sure, for everyone. Mm-hmm. And it's very good to be back, and I have many things to tell other friends that were here during the war, and what they wouldn't know it in the same place, and walk down the street or drive down the street, it's no different than being in the city of Swayze back on the mainland. Yeah. And so that's, but like I say, my main reason is that it's something that I've been wanting to do for all these years and planned on it, and I'm here.
The park here was established to commemorate the bravery and sacrifices of all people from all nations who participated in World War II. What, if anything, would you like to see here at the park?
Anything that is possible to get to. Just here for about 12 days, and like I told my wife, I said, yeah, there probably won't be any stone unturned that we haven't seen. So, of course, that's kind of exaggerating things, but Jack has shown us a lot of our places that we were, and it seems to be a little more brush and trees than there was, and it's kind of hard to locate everything, but we're doing a good job of it, and looking forward to seeing everything that there is to be seen.
Is there anything that you would like to add personally to the oral history? Is there anything else that you would like to add?
Well, it's been kind of, if I was sure what I was going to say, I could have had a regular story I could have written, but mm-hmm. Like I say, this is a hit and miss deal. I jumped around from one time, one period to another, and it got back to the other I started out with, and I hope it'll make some sense to you.
Okay. Well, on behalf of the National Park Service, I'd like to thank you for your contribution to our oral history studies.
One thing I will say, I was not on the front lines too much, other than in and out with supplies, and because, well, if I'd have been needed on the front lines, then I'd have been there, but primarily my job was in supply, and when we were able, we'd set our field kitchens up and serve hot chow to the troops on the front lines. And when you're in the commissary department, you're everything. Like I say, you get back to the pack mule, you're packing ammunition and anything that the troops need, you can help get to them. And when we set up our field mess and start cooking beans and what have you, get to the troops, we do that too. In other words, you're just kind of like a general laborer. We take orders from whoever's in charge of us. That's it. So just do your job. And like I say, then there's times that you're on the front lines as a frontline man, you're having to do your killing just like anybody else. Yeah, I'm probably thinking a lot of things I could have said later, but I guess that's going to be it. And I hope that's is some information for you.
Yeah, it does help when I we have a lot of documents and stuff.